Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Cure Panel talk show on myeloma. I'm Priya Menon, scientific media editor at Cure Panel, joining you from India. And I welcome all of you this evening to a discussion on multiple myeloma. This is Cure Panel's 70th episode, and today on our myeloma broadcast, we are discussing minimal residual disease. My co-host for the show is myeloma survivor and editor of MyelomaSurvival.com, Gary Peterson. On the panel are Cure panelists Pat Killingsworth, Jack Ayilu, Nick Van Dyke, and Cynthia Schmilowski. I welcome everyone to the show today. We have with us today a very eminent expert, Dr. Guido Tricott. Welcome to the show, Dr. Tricott. It's great to have you with us.
You're welcome.
Gary Peterson will now introduce our story expert and begin with the discussion. Before I hand over to Gary, I would like to tell all listeners that we will be addressing questions towards the end of the show. And if you want to ask a question to our panel, you can press 1 on your keypads and we will bring you on air to ask your question. Alternatively, you can email your question to me. Mailing ID is priya@trialx.com. With that, it's over to Gary. Gary, you're on air.
Okay. Thank you very much, Priya. I appreciate it. And as always, thank you so much for providing this forum for all the patients in the myeloma patient community. Dr. Guido Tricott is the director of the Holden Cancer Center Bone Marrow Transplant and Myeloma Program at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. He specializes in multiple myeloma and has been researching and treating myeloma for over 20 years. His team's treatment strategy includes tandem autologous transplants, and this approach has increased the median survival for myeloma to 10 years or more as compared to 2.5 to 3 years when he first started to treat patients. He received his medical and doctorate degree at the University, I believe it's of Louvain in Belgium. And before joining the Holden Cancer Center, he was the director, and not only the director, but he really developed the program at Utah Blood and Marrow Transplant and Myeloma Program at Huntsman Cancer Institute, effectively bringing the program that he helped develop at the University of Arkansas at the Myeloma Institute and of Research and Therapy, where he, with a number of other eminent doctors, have gone on to develop their own programs in other locations, like he did at Huntsman, as well as now at Iowa. So thank you so much, Doctor, for being here today and for discussing MRD, or minimum residual disease. I had read an article that you had written, which was titled, and it was out in 2007, so it almost seems like you were clairvoyant or just way ahead of your time, and wrote about what is the significance, and it was in 2007, what is the significance of molecular remission in multiple myeloma? I read it, and I got to tell you that my head really was kind of spinning because it was just full of pretty in-depth understanding of the remission for multiple myeloma. And I was wondering if molecular remission is the same thing as MRD, or minimal residual disease. And so in that vein, in the same line of questioning and answering the question of what is the significance, so what is the significance of MRD in multiple myeloma?
Well, the fact that we can now talk about minimal residual disease in myeloma is a testimony to how much progress we have made in the last 20 years. As you said initially, when we started the myeloma program in Arkansas around 1990, the median survival was 2.5 years, and the general motto was, don't treat patients with myeloma too aggressively. because they are so brittle and they will fall apart as soon as you start to do something more aggressive. It was not until around 1982 that a little progress was made with the introduction of high-dose melphalan by a guy in England called Tim McIlwain. And he treated patients with plasma cell leukemia and very aggressive myeloma. And he saw for the first time that he could achieve a complete remission in 3 or 5 patients treated that way, which was unheard of. The general complete remission rate was less than 5% with the conventional treatments, and less than 5% of the patients survived more than 10 years. The median survival was about 2.5 years. And it should also be said that people were discouraged from increasing the treatment because little bits of increasing treatment did not result in better outcomes. It was not until really a big step forward was taken by giving the high-dose melphalan that better results were being seen. The problem with the way that McIlwain gave the treatment is that patients had no counts, no white cells, no platelets for about 5 to 6 weeks. And this was not a practical way. People had to be in isolation for 5 to 6 weeks, and that's why it did not get accepted as a treatment modality. And in the late 1980s, Dr. Barlogi, to his credit, thought, well, if the major problem is that patients have these long periods with no counts, why don't we support them with their own stem cells? The problem was that most of the patients that he treated at that point in time had quite a bit of myeloma in the bone marrow, and people were saying, oh, this guy is crazy. He's trying to cure myeloma and then infuses myeloma back in stem cells, and this is never going to work. His idea was that, well, the normal stem cells will recover much faster than the myeloma will recover, and patients will have a benefit. And you have to remember that in the late 1980s, transplants were only done with the intention of curing people, while his intention was, let's try to prolong their life significantly and improve their quality of life by better controlling the disease. The generally accepted hypothesis that patients with myeloma were too brittle was not because those patients were in bad shape overall, but because of their myeloma. And if we could control their myeloma much better, those patients would be in much better shape. And that was the hypothesis that we tried to test by giving transplants. Now, we knew that we were now dealing with patients in their 50s and 60s and 70s. These were not young kids like with leukemia or lymphoma. These were older people. So the first thing we wanted to make sure is that we did not kill too many people by giving our intensive treatments. And to make sure that
That's
we didn't do
that. A very good goal.
Yeah. And and to get to that result, we decided instead of giving an extremely high dose of chemotherapy all at once, let's try to do this in 2 consecutive steps. And that's how the tandem transplants started. Give a lower dose each time, but make sure that the patients do not die of their high-dose chemotherapy.
So previous to this, the dose was what? One dose, but twice as much, and it was... I didn't understand that to be the case. But.
No, not in myeloma. This was in leukemia. People were giving extremely intensive regimens to try to cure disease with one single intervention. And the regimens were so intensive that they were called scary. There was this leukemia regimen given by UCLA that was called scary because it was so intense and so scary that a lot of the younger people could not even take it. If you would have given such an intensive treatment to people in their 50s, 60s, and 70s, we would have killed half of our patients. And then everybody would have said, oh, this is not doable. We cannot do this. We need to go back to the milder treatments. So that's why we gave a lower dose of melphalan, which at that point in time was 200 milligrams per meter square, and we gave that twice. And we thought people can tolerate that and can get through this safely. And we indeed showed that the mortality rate with this type of regimens was no more than 2 to 3%, and was not any higher than 6 months of VAD treatment, which was the most used therapy at that point in time, away from transplantation. So that's how the tandem transplant started. And the major progress since that time has been by combining the tandem transplants with the newer drugs. The newer drugs work in a different way than our classical chemotherapy and are able to eradicate cells that we cannot eradicate with conventional chemotherapy. And when I talk about the newer drugs, I'm talking about Velcade, thalidomide, Revlimid, and now more recently pomalidomide and carfilzomib. And by giving maintenance therapy after the two transplants for a certain period of time with a combination of those drugs, we have made a tremendous advance in overall survival. And as you said in the beginning, the median survival in our total therapy 2 trial for the thalidomide arm, which had more than 300 patients, was 10 years. And total therapy 3 clearly looks better than that, but still doesn't have enough follow-up to give us 10-year data. But it is expected that it will be in the 12-year range. And more importantly, what we see now is that at 10 years, patients who achieve a complete remission, 10 years later, half of those patients, when they are treated with maintenance therapy, are still in complete remission. And, you know, in the myeloma field, there is this big divide. On the one hand, people who think, well, myeloma can never be treated, and therefore you're not justified to give intensive treatments. And the other camp that says, well, we think myeloma can be cured, and therefore we are justified to give this very intensive treatments. The problem with this approach is that people who don't treat intensively don't see cures, and that basically makes their belief harder that this is not a curable disease, and they keep on thinking this is not a curable disease. While if we can keep patients in a complete remission, and 80% of the patients these days achieve a complete remission, and of those 80%, half of those patients are still in complete remission at 10 years, if we can do that, it's hard for me to believe that this is not a curable disease. Unfortunately, it requires very prolonged treatments and very intensive treatments. So this is where we are now. Now we want to know who is the most likely to be cured and do well with our treatments. And that's where the minimal residual disease comes in. Minimal residual disease means that we are trying to find disease that cannot easily be detected by our bone marrows and our blood tests and our urine tests. You have to have more sensitive parameters. In the old days, it was mainly done by PCR techniques, which were very difficult to do, very labor-intensive, and could only be done in 70% of the patients. These days, it's mainly done by very complicated flow cytometry, which is very difficult to analyze, but it's all automatically analyzed. And therefore, if you have the right programs, you can do the analysis within a short period of time. Usually within 24 hours, you know what your result is, and you know whether patients still have residual disease or not.
So, just, you know, NCR, you know, well, there's a miss, you know, like in a lot of cancers, CR is complete remission.
Yeah.
Complete remission means there is no cancer and it's not coming back, right?
No, that's not complete remission. That's what
but
people misunderstand.
But not for multiple myeloma. I understand.
No, but also for other diseases. When we talk about complete remission, it means that by all the means that we have available to us, we can no longer detect any evidence of cancer. But that's not the same as there is no disease at all left anymore. People in complete remission can still relapse. People with leukemia can go into complete remission and their disease can come back because we were not able to detect the very minimal amounts of disease. And those minimal amounts of disease, we have tried to do better by introducing minimal residual disease parameters. And in leukemia, they have been very effective. And the reason why it has been more effective in leukemia than probably in myeloma is that leukemia is spread out over the bone marrow completely evenly. Whether you do a bone marrow in your breastbone or in your pelvic bone, you will see the same results. Myeloma is different. Myeloma cells have the tendency to form big clumps. And in between the clumps, there can be nothing. And when you do a bone marrow in between those clumps, you may think, well, there's no myeloma at all. And you do a bone marrow in one of those clumps and you think, oh, everything is myeloma. And the only way to really know what the extent of myeloma is to do either a PET scan or an MRI. That will tell you where the disease is and how much disease there is. So in myeloma, we are dependent not only on the fact that this disease is focal, it has focal areas, in other areas there's nothing. And when you do your bone marrow, you may be in a good area or in a bad area. And the results will be completely different whether you do your bone marrow, your random bone marrow, in a good area or in a bad area. That's why it's very well possible. And in about 25% of the patients, when we do this minimal residual disease evaluation with flow cytometry, we still see that they have an M protein or an immunofixation electrophoresis, still have a monoclonal band. So for us to say minimal residual disease, we really need to make sure that there is no M protein, that there is no serum immunofixation electrophoresis that shows a monoclonal band, that the free light chains in the serum are totally normal, that the bone marrow does not contain more than 2% plasma cells, and that the plasma cells we see are polytypic, meaning that they are staining for kappa and lambda and not just for what the myeloma was. If you have an IgG kappa and all your myelomas and all the plasma cells you see in your bone marrow are kappa, you know there's still disease. If you have an IgG lambda myeloma and you see that it's only 2%, but all the 2% of the myeloma cells stain with lambda, you know there's still disease around. If the disease is in complete remission, kappa and lambda should both be present, and that tells you that you're on the right track.
Very, very interesting.
Yeah.
One of the things that you mentioned in your paper was that NCR, you can still have as much as 1 billion myeloma, 10 to the 9th is what it was, which is 1 billion myeloma cells in your blood. So,
Body.
In your body. So what is the measurement for, I guess depending on colors, you can get, if you got 6-color flow cytometry, 9-color, 14-color, I don't know where they go. Has anybody decided on what the standard is? And has it been developed?
In the United States, it has not been developed. But in Europe, there has been a panel that has come together and has decided how to do this. They tell you exactly what antibodies to use, that you have to have 6 colors, that you need to use at least 500,000 events to analyze 500,000 cells of the bone marrow to see whether there's any evidence of disease or not. So those standards are available through the European organization. And it's high time that the same norms are implemented here in the United States, that we are all talking about the same thing.
But what do you use?
We use what the Europeans are telling us to do. That's a panel of specialists that have come together that are all specialists in immunofluorescence and flow cytometry, and they have a very good proposal of how to look at minimal residual disease, and that's what we are following. And I hope that most of the other institutions are doing the same thing.
Okay, one last question before we go on to the panel, and it's a big question, and that question. So the test that you would do would be you'd have to be negative. You'd have zero events in 500,000. Is that correct?
You would have to have zero abnormal events. You know
okay.
that in normal bone marrow there are always normal plasma cells, and
okay,
normal plasma cells have certain markers on their membranes which are different from myeloma plasma cells.
Okay.
So
the big question is, if you have no negative results,
yeah.
does that mean cure?
No. No. If you have a negative result, that doesn't mean cure, because, as I told you before, 25% of patients with negative flow cytometry still have evidence either by PET scan, MRI, blood, serum immunofixation electrophoresis, urine immunofixation electrophoresis, kappa lambda ratios to show that there is still evidence of disease. And so
all
you need to do all these things together. And when they're all negative, and that's what we call now a stringent complete remission. And if you have a stringent complete remission, then your chances that you will do well over the long period of time is extremely high. And that has been very well demonstrated by a recent paper by the Mayo Clinic, where they saw that about 25% of their patients achieved a stringent complete remission, meaning their bone marrow was negative, their flow was negative, their immunofixation electrophoresis were negative, their kappa lambda ratios were normal. Everything showed, there's nothing that showed any evidence of disease, and those patients did extremely well. They did much, much better than patients who were in a CR in the old way we defined, and at the survival that was twice as long. But still, even in that group, they see that the median time to progression is about 5 to 6 years. And I think if we, with our more intensive treatments where we give 2 transplants and 2 years of maintenance therapy, we see stringent complete remissions, not in 25%, but in more than 50% of our patients. And we hope that our median survivals are going to be significantly longer than with lesser therapy. But what we have learned over all these years is that it's very hard to give too much treatment to myeloma patients. The major problem is still their disease coming back, and not that people are dying of the treatments. They are dying of the disease coming back. And we need to do everything we can and use all the tools we have to achieve a stringent complete remission and give them enough treatment with the newer drugs combined with tandem transplants to have the best overall outcomes.
Fantastic, doctor. Thank you so much. What I'd like to do now is go on to the questions of the panel. And Cindy?
I'm here.
Are you online?
Can you hear
okay.
me?
Okay. Would you please ask your question and then one follow-up, and that's how we'll do it today.
Okay. Sounds great. Thanks for all the information you've given us so far, doctor. It's very enlightening. And my question is about some terms I've been hearing thrown around. I've heard about MRD zero and MRD negative. I was wondering if those two terms mean the same thing. If not, what's the difference? Do different institutions use those terms differently? Like, is there a standardization? So maybe that's the first part of my question.
Yeah. So the official term is MRD negative. But
okay.
Dr. Brian Dury has introduced this MRD zero, which is basically the same thing. But when you read papers, they will talk about MRD negativity, not about MRD zero, but it's basically the same thing.
Okay. And then my next part of the question is, it seems so important to get down to MRD negative that our long-term survival as a patient, you know, is much better if we get to that degree. And once we get tested, and these tests become standardized, I'm sure we'll know better. But what about the patient who's been given their induction therapy, their consolidation, their maintenance, everything's gone, and they still haven't seen MRD negative, there may not be in a complete remission, but they have stable disease, and would you suggest that maybe a more aggressive therapy be given to that patient, or would you wait and see until that patient progresses? How important it is it to get to MRD negative your first time around.
Yeah. So MRD negativity is especially important in patients with poor prognosis myeloma. Patients who have 414 translocation, 1416 translocation, deletion 17, 1420 translocations, those patients have aggressive disease. And if those patients do not achieve a stringent complete remission, not only MRD negative, but also their M proteins are normal and their immunofixation electrophoresis are normal and their kappa lambda ratios are normal and their serum free lights are normal, when you achieve that in patients with high-risk disease, then you have a good chance that those patients will do very well. If you don't achieve that, they will do very poorly. So in high-risk patients, we really try to get to a stringent complete remission as defined by the Mayo group. In patients who have more benign myeloma, it is not so important to achieve a minimal residual disease negativity status. Some of those patients, they really don't go into a complete remission, but they go back into what we call an MGUS phase, monoclonal gammopathy of undetermined significance, that can be stable for many, many years. I have patients who never achieved a complete remission, and 12 years later, they still have this minimal amount of disease, just like an MGUS patient. They have not evolved at all. They have not needed any treatment. And so in those patients, you need to make sure that you don't over-treat those patients and that you don't prematurely use weapons of chemotherapy that you later on will need. So there's no need to treat those patients. If it's especially important that you get to MRD negativity and to stringent complete remission in high-risk myeloma patients.
Okay, and so that group of patients that revert back to that MGUS type stage, would this flow cytometry test that we're talking about now identify the characteristic of those groups of patients who might not necessarily need a complete, a stringent complete remission?
It's not the flow cytometry that will tell you that. What will tell you that is the genetic testing, the FISH analysis, the cytogenetic analysis, and the gene expression profiling. Those types of tests are going to tell you whether you have a high-risk or a low-risk disease. And if you have a low-risk disease and you see the patients not going to complete remission, you follow them very carefully with monthly markers, and you see whether the disease remains stable or whether it tends to go up again. If it tends to go up again, you have to treat more. But many of those will remain stable for many, many years.
Okay, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Okay, all right. Nick, are you on the line?
I am. Can you hear me?
You bet. Loud and clear.
Great. So, first, at the risk of embarrassing the good doctor, I wanted to thank him in this forum. He may not make the connection with my name, but he's been kind.
Oh, yes, I do.
I want to just publicly say you've been kind enough, even though I've been treated by one of your former colleagues, Dr. Barlege, you've been kind enough to be a sounding board for me over the years at various points of my therapy. And, you know, we're all with this disease, have a pretty crummy hand in terms of it being an orphan and many people think incurable disease, but I think that's offset by a remarkable community of researchers and physicians like yourself who are extremely kind and really dedicated to helping all of us. So I wanted to thank you and just call you out for that.
Thank you for this kind remark.
Of course. So a great overview of where we stand with MRD. So I have two quick questions for me anyhow. The best metaphor I've heard, and it ties to what you were saying, is that when you do a bone marrow analysis, it's like looking at a Dalmatian. You might get a white spot, you might get a black spot.
Exactly.
Is there any number of, and I've heard the term now, sequentially negative MRD related to, you know, half a dozen MRD tests over a number of years that are all negative from different spots. Is there any number of sequential negative MRDs using multiflow cytometry that are corroborated by all the other tests required to get the stringent complete remission that can really give confidence, or do we still need a serum blood test for MRD, and if so, how close are we to getting that?
I think if you want to be confident that you're really MRD negative, you need to have at least 3 or 4 negative samples in a row. Other than that, I would not count too much on it. You also have to remember that when they do a bone marrow on you, the first sample they will use for to look at the abnormal cells, the morphology. The second sample will be done for chromosome analysis. The third sample will be done for FISH analysis, and the fourth sample will be used for flow cytometry. By that time, you may have diluted your bone marrow so much with peripheral blood that you really don't have pure bone marrow anymore, and that you can be fooled by thinking it's negative, while it's only due to the fact that that you're looking at blood and not at bone marrow anymore, or mainly blood and little bone marrow. So ultimately, the best test will be a blood test, because all the myeloma cells can only go from one place to another place, from one bone marrow spot to another bone marrow spot, by going through the blood. And there are very sensitive techniques with deep sequencing where we can detect parts of cells that are circulating in the patient and see whether they are still present in low amounts of in low amounts, or whether they are completely negative. And ultimately, my prediction is that it's going to be a blood test and not a bone marrow test that will tell us whether patients are really in MRD negativity or not.
And is that something that's making its way from research into practice?
It's being done in other diseases, and I'm sure people are working now on myeloma. We are working at least on a test like that too, where we take bone marrow, where we take peripheral blood, and then compare the two and see whether we can get as much information out of the blood as out of the bone marrow. And not only is that important for MRD, but I cannot imagine that patients are going to complain and that they are missing their every 3 month or every 6 month bone marrow that we do on them.
Yeah, I often joke with Barlegy that I look like I've gone hunting with Dick Cheney. That's so much buckshot.
Exactly. So if we can get the same information from peripheral blood and we don't need bone marrows anymore, I think we will have done a major benefit to myeloma patients.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Nick. And, Doctor, I also must cross paths with you. You didn't know it, but in 2006 I was treated at Little Rock, Arkansas as well. And I think
okay.
I've seen you walking through the, through the aisles and in the hospital. Pat Killingsworth, are you online?
I'm here, Gary.
Okay, your questions.
Quickly, before my question, just to point out the broad difference in philosophy in treating multiple myeloma, you wonder how it could be so. There could be such a difference. So today I saw my myeloma specialist, Dr. Roy, at Mayo Clinic Jacksonville, and I haven't had a bone marrow biopsy for almost 2 years. And I asked him about that. I said, isn't it time for me to get a bone marrow biopsy, yada, yada, yada. Doctor, by the way, I'm recovering from a third relapse. And he looked at me and he said, well, we already know what it's doing. I don't think you need a biopsy. So it's just, and that's Mayo Clinic. So it's just interesting, you know, the two spectrums here. And I guess my question for you is, so how is MRD testing going to help the 50,000 or more living myeloma patients in the United States that didn't treat this the way you would have liked to see them treated? That started with an incremental approach or went to their local medical oncologist and just did Rev-Dex or Velcade-Dex or something like that and progressively moved through. How does the new testing help us?
Well, it's very difficult to achieve minimal residual disease and a stringent complete remission without at some point in time having had a transplant. Most of the patients that have not had a transplant, you will either have your light chain still being abnormal, or there will be minimal residual disease in the bone marrow, or there will be other evidence of disease. Those drugs are really not strong enough to kill the large majority of the myeloma cells. People can achieve a complete remission, but a complete remission defined in the old way, meaning the bone marrow is less than 5% plasma cells and I don't see an M protein on my serum protein electrophoresis, and the immunofixation electrophoresis is negative. People have myelomas that do, and especially when they relapse, that do not secrete a lot of protein anymore, because the cells become more and more immature. And mature plasma cells secrete a lot of immunoglobulin per cell per day. The more immature the cells and the more aggressive the cells get, the less immunoglobulin they secrete, because they're not mature enough to secrete a lot. And so those markers can be easy, can be very misleading, especially in relapsed patients, where you see, well, my M protein is zero, my kappa lambda ratio is normal, so I must not have disease. And then you do a bone marrow and you see 30-40% plasma cells. And so you really need to have all the parts of the puzzles. You need to have your blood and urine. You need to have your bone marrow, and you need to have an imaging test, whether it's a PET scan or an MRI. And when you have all these pieces of the puzzle together, then you can evaluate whether a patient is in a complete remission and is going to do well or not. If you have a complete remission but the PET scan is still positive, I can guarantee you it will not be long before the disease is back there.
Sure. Sure. Is it too late for somebody, let's say someone was diagnosed last November and they've been on RVD and doing well, is it too late for them to try to go the TT route and
it's never
do
too
the
late
tandem transplants? And
it's never too late. We see the best results in patients who have had less than 12 months of prior therapy. And when I was in Little Rock and I analyzed the patients who had 1 month of treatment or less versus those who had less than 6 months or less than 12 months, we didn't see a lot of difference between 1 month or less of prior treatment and less than 6 months of prior treatment. Between 6 and 12 months, it started to get a little worse. But after 12 months of treatment with non-transplant regimens, then it really starts to decrease. The impact of transplantation starts to decrease, and the results are clearly inferior.
Interesting. So Gary, is that where you fall? Is that one reason you've done so well? Your initial therapy, when you're worried about your kidney failure, right? You didn't really do full TT right away. When did you do TT? How long had you been treated?
Well, I was I was at Mayo Clinic, and I was treated for about 4 months, and then I went
to Little
Rock.
Yeah.
So I fell in that, and probably it was 6 months before I. So I was right at that six-month place. But before I went in, you know, Mayo Clinic, and I had Dr. Roy, had given me Cytoxan, thalidomide, and dexamethasone, and my M-spike went to nothing, and my lambda light chains also went to nothing. So when I went to Little Rock, you know, I was already in remission.
Sure. Super. Well, thank you, Doctor.
Okay, you're welcome.
Yes, thank you, Doctor. We have Jack. Are you on the line?
Yep, I'm here, and I've really enjoyed hearing you speak, Dr. Zwicko. One thing I'll add before I ask a question, because I asked, this is for Cindy, I asked Dr. Dury last month exactly the same question you did. What's the difference between MRD negative and MRD zero? And what he said was that MRD negative is a given test result. MRD zero will be, the terminology will be used to say that you are MRD negative over a certain time frame, so 6 months or a year or whatever it is. So, but I don't know if that's well understood or really articulated by everyone at this point.
I don't think so. I don't think that is generally accepted term.
I don't think
maybe
so.
Maybe it will come up, but it's not generally accepted at this point in time.
Yeah, because we have the same questions.
Yeah.
The question, I have a few questions for you. I had thought that with the IMF's Black Swan Initiative and the International Myeloma Working Group and their workings with the Spanish group and their working with the FDA and such, that the definition that was going to be used for flow cytometry was pretty well agreed upon. And maybe that doesn't mean the whole definition for MRD negative is well agreed upon, but at least the flow agreement was done, that they would be taking, I think it was 9 antigens or something like that. But
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. The Black Swan analysis used European standards.
Okay. And then the second question, so I guess I wonder, when I'm looking at clinical trial today, I do see sometimes MRD as being a secondary objective that they'll be looking at and hope that everybody is using the same definition of MRD. You think that's the case?
I think what we should be using is the Mayo terminology of stringent complete remission, not only looking at flow, but also looking at blood, at urine, at bone marrow morphology and things like that. Everything together, and everything needs to be negative to really call it MRD negative. If you just base it on the flow cytometry, you can be misled, not because the flow cytometry is not sensitive enough, but because of the quality of your sample or where the sample was taken. As was said by one of the previous speakers, if you go in between two black spots in a Dalmatian, you think everything is white, but you're wrong. And if you go into a black spot, you think that everything is black on that dog, and you're wrong too.
Yeah, and I agree, and I think that's what the definition of MRD testing is going to be, that it will include blood tests and free light tests, PET scans and such.
Yeah, and so the most comprehensive terminology at this point in time to reflect that is the stringent complete remission, and that's the terminology I think we should be using.
Got it. And the final question I have is, I live in Northern California, which is home to a company called Sequenta, who is promoting a competing test against flow, having to do with next generation sequencing.
Yeah.
And can you say a little bit more about why flow should be definitely chosen over sequences testing?
Deep sequencing is probably the method of the future. The problem is that there's not a lot of real hard data with that. And the largest study published on genomes on deep sequencing was on 133 patients. And it can detect less myeloma cells than lesser amounts of myeloma cells than the flow cytometry. Flow cytometry, in general, you can detect 1 in 10,000 cells. This deep sequencing can detect 1 in 1,000,000 abnormal cells. So it's more sensitive. But we need to wait to see whether there is really a benefit in going that sensitive. Okay? When we look at other diseases like CLL, chronic lymphocytic leukemia, for example, they have not found that more sensitive tests were necessarily better than flow cytometry. So we will need to see that. But it's also possible that the deep sequencing can ultimately tell us whether the clone that survives is an MGUS clone or is really part of the myeloma that needs to be treated. And that's the hope we have of the deep sequencing.
So both types of tests can detect clonal variations?
No. The flow cytometry will not tell you whether the cells that you see are benign MGUS cells or whether they are aggressive cells. The deep sequencing, where you look at the genes, at the sequence of the genes, that can tell you whether you're dealing with a more innocent or a more aggressive clone.
Thank you very much.
Okay. You're welcome.
Thank you very much, Doctor. I had just one additional question, then we'll go to the callers. But originally, like TT1 had, I think, two conditioning components and two transplants, then two consolidations plus maintenance. And over time, they've really gone to one conditioning, or two transplants and one consolidation and then maintenance. So effectively, you know, the intensity of the treatment has gone down. But as that's happened, the new drugs that came into play, first thalidomide, then Revlimid, this is for total therapy, and then, or then Velcade, then Revlimid. Now, is, given that, is it, and then, you know, although it was less intense, had new drugs, the results improved from like 10% to like 28% to like 50% effective cure rate. So is it more of the drugs?
It's more of different drugs. In the old days, we used all drugs that worked in a similar way, like typical chemotherapy. It mainly attacks the most rapidly dividing cells. Now the newer drugs, they work in a completely different way, and if you can only give so much of a certain class of drugs. If you want to have the best results, you need to combine everything that you have available. And that's why Barlogy called this total therapy. Don't wait and hold back on some treatments because you think, at relapse, I still need to have something. Give all you have and try to cure patients. And that has been the strategy that has worked the best. So in the old days when we didn't have Velcade and we didn't have thalidomide, the only thing we could rely on is regular chemotherapy. And with regular chemotherapy, there's only so much one can use. And if you look at the relapse rate at 5 years in our Total Therapy 1 study, which had two transplants and basically no maintenance therapy, 75% had relapsed at 5 years. If you now look at Total Therapy 3 with the Velcade and the thalidomide and the Revlimid, you see that about 25% of the patients have relapsed. So the relapse rate at 5 years has come down from 75% to 25%. And that decline is mainly due to the introduction of the newer drugs. Having drugs that works that work in different ways is always much better than using drugs that work all in a similar way.
You know, I had really thought this whole MRD thing was going to provide us with a method of treatment that would say, okay, let's look at your genetics. These are your genetics. Given your genetics, these are the three drugs that you need, and this is the, you know, you need a, you do need or you don't need a transplant. You do it, and as a result, you don't give too much, you don't give too little, but you just give just right to meet this new MRD target, so that you wouldn't have to necessarily throw everything at it up front. But sounds like we're not quite there yet.
We're certainly not quite there yet at this point in time. We know very well, based on genetics, who will do poorly. But what we have a lesser clue of is who will ultimately do extremely well, has a 90% cure rate at 10 years, and therefore we can see whether we can decrease the treatment intensity. As you know, this testing with gene expression profiling and so on started in 2003. So that means it's about 11 years old. So it's very easy. The early relapses, they come early and you can find out who is going to do poorly. It's much more difficult to find out who will have a 90% chance of still being in complete remission at 10 years because you need to have a much longer follow-up and we are not there yet.
Okay. Well, thank you so much. Obviously, now I know why my head was spinning when I was reading your thing. Your head must hurt because it's got so much knowledge in it.
Well, I get used to the headaches.
All right. Now I'd like to go to the callers. Priya, could you bring on some callers or some of the questions?
Yes, thank you. Yes, thank you, Gary. Listeners, if you have a question for Dr. Trico, please press 1 on your keyboard and we can bring you on air to ask your question live. While we wait for them, Dr. Trico, maybe we could go over some of the submitted questions. The first question one of our listeners has sent in is that if a patient is in complete remission, 2 years out from a tandem stem cell transplant, having been on Revlimid maintenance for the 2 years, can being tested for MRD be useful to decide whether to continue on maintenance or have a drug-free holiday?
Again, like many of our things that we do in myeloma, there's a lot of controversy about how to do things. Some people maintain after transplantation with Revlimid only drug. Our philosophy has been to give combinations of drugs. We typically give Velcade, thalidomide, and dexamethasone, or Velcade, Revlimid, and dexamethasone, or Velcade, cyclophosphamide, and dexamethasone post-transplantation. The chances that you will kill more cells by giving combination therapy is much higher than by a single drug. And especially in patients with high-risk disease, and especially those with deletion of chromosome 17, it's important that they are maintained on a proteasome inhibitor like Velcade or carfilzomib rather than on an IMiD like thalidomide or Revlimid. But again, the combination is better than each drug separately. And if you give combination therapy, I don't think you have to go on forever and ever and ever. I think 2 years of maintenance therapy, that's what we apply, and I think that's more than enough. It's hard to imagine that a cell that has seen 2 years of maintenance therapy with your Velcade and your IMiD and has not been killed by that treatment will all at once be killed in the third year of treatment.
Thank you, Dr. Trico. I think you answered another question sent by one of our participants who were asking, like, what is your approach to maintenance therapy if you are have minimal residual disease? Our next question is from our listener who says that he has multiple myeloma. My tests show that the N protein has been undetectable for the past 18 months. My blood work is completely normal. I'm no longer taking any Revlimid or any other prescription drug. Will MRD testing confirm at what level of remission I am at?
Yes, that would be a good test to do an flow cytometry on the bone marrow and see where there is still evidence of disease. Most of the people that have not gone through transplantation will still have MRD positivity. And it's only like 3 to 4% of those patients that will really be MRD negative.
We have a caller calling in to ask a question, right? A person calling in from 210-846-1168, you're live. Please ask your question.
Hi. Yeah, my name is Blan. I'm from Texas. I'm a patient of Dr. Krikos. I was with him in Salt Lake City and now at the University of Iowa. And I was just wanting to get some, I guess, some clarification. We talked about the MRD negative and the complete stringent remission. Are we talking basically about the same thing when we talk about those two terms?
MRD refers to flow cytometry. So when on flow cytometry you don't see any evidence that there is an abnormal cell present, you call it MRD negative. Stringent complete remission means MRD negativity, but also the immunofixation electrophoresis needs to be negative in the blood and the urine. The M-protein needs to be negative in the blood and the urine. So stringent complete remission encompasses more than MRD.
Okay. Now, I for one will miss the 3 month bone marrow biopsy, so I'm not really in favor of that.
Our next caller calling in from 917-685-2380. Please ask your question.
Yeah, hi, Dr. Trico. I have a question concerning smoldering multiple myeloma. I've heard the term ultra-high-risk smoldering myeloma, which I understand is more likely early disease without CRAB. And the new thought is perhaps earlier treatment intervention. Do you agree, and would you treat these patients aggressively as you would a newly diagnosed myeloma patient?
Well, that's a complicated question. When I visited the NIH, because they were doing a trial on smoldering myeloma, and I said, can you give me the features of those patients? And I saw those patients. I saw that many of those patients had either PET scan lesions or MRI lesions, but their skeletal survey was negative, and they were called smoldering myeloma. in my opinion, anybody who has a PET scan lesion and you do a biopsy and it shows myeloma cells, or an MRI lesion and you do a biopsy and it has myeloma cells, for me is bone disease and therefore should be treated as aggressively as patients who have myeloma. The definitions of smoldering myeloma vary, and I think nobody should be diagnosed with smoldering myeloma without having had a PET scan or an MRI. And most of what they called high-risk smoldering myelomas were patients who had negative skeletal surveys, but the PET scan was positive or the MRI was positive. And again, those patients we would call myeloma patients and not smoldering myeloma patients.
So obviously, then you would treat them just as you would
exactly.
a myeloma patient.
Yeah. If I see a patient that has an MRI lesion and a single or a few myeloma lesions look like myeloma lesions, I would do a fine needle aspiration in those patients, making sure that I deal with myeloma cells. And if I can confirm that, then I treat them as if they have myeloma.
What about the patients, Dr. Trico, that don't have the PET scan or the MRI positivity, but they have that greater than 60% tumor burden or those very high free light chain ratios? Because I'm understanding that that's more or less the so-called new definition of that term, ultra-high-risk smoldering
yeah.
myeloma.
Well,
would you treat someone like that?
If they don't have PET lesions and I see their light chains, they might be high, but they stay in the same range, or I see their M protein that might be 4 or 5 grams, and it stays in the same range, as long as it stays in the same range, I would not treat them. And I've seen many of those patients doing well for 3, 4, 5, 6 years before they ultimately needed treatment.
And ultimately, that would be determined by a PET, a positive PET or a positive
either,
MRI?
Yeah, either a positive PET scan, positive MRI, or chromosomal abnormalities that were not there before, or some evidence that the disease is clearly progressing, the M protein clearly going up, the light chains instead of being stable, worsening, all those things would make me think that they now have overt myeloma, that they are progressing and not stable anymore.
So you don't really see a benefit at treating a lower tumor burden stage without those CRAB elements. Okay, thank you.
Well, and unless you define CRAB skeletal lesions by skeletal survey, that is not sensitive enough.
Okay.
It needs to be defined by MRI or PET scan. But if there is no lesions and everything is stable otherwise, I would not treat.
Okay. Do you support the use of Zometa, the bisphosphonates, or Iridia for smoldering patients? And if yes, why and how often? Can it actually forestall progression?
The first fact that you need to know is even patients with MGUS and smoldering myeloma clearly have decreased bone density and therefore benefit from bisphosphonates. There is also evidence in animals, especially in mice, showing that if you give early on the bisphosphonates, that it will actually prevent the spreading of the disease and will prevent progression to myeloma. So for those reasons, I put all my patients who have smoldering myeloma or MGUS on bisphosphonates, and usually once every 3 months for as long as they are in the MGUS phase or the smoldering phase.
Very good. Thank you so much for your time, Dr. Trico.
You're welcome.
We just have a couple of minutes more. Dr. Trico, it has been wonderful listening to you, and I would like to thank you and all the CURE panelists. Before we close for today, we have a special announcement by one of our CURE panelists, Dana Holmes, and she wants to talk about a new initiative. Dana, you're on air.
Thank you, Priya. Actually, that was my call into Dr. Trico. I called in on my cell phone because I wasn't quite sure if you'd be able to pull that call up. So thank you for taking that as well. Priya, thank you for inviting me to share our new awareness initiative with your listeners. We launched the Mambo for Myeloma Awareness Dance Challenge initiative on September 1st, which was the first day of Blood Cancer Awareness Month. We believe awareness matters. It can build a bridge to increase donations to research organizations to help them help us find a cure. it's especially true, I think, outside of the immediate myeloma community. If you've never heard of myeloma, you're not likely to donate to a cause established for it. Your immediate family and friends will likely donate on your behalf, but beyond that inner circle, it's not very likely. There are lots of different events in place, races, runs, walks, marches, singing. We even found a skydiving event. And this Mambo for Myeloma Awareness Challenge, we feel, could complement each of those efforts. It can be initiated by anyone at any time, anywhere, any way. It's not seasonal. Awareness is really a year-round endeavor. You can raise funds for research with it, or you could just do it for the awareness aspect. You know, we saw the success of the Ice Bucket Challenge for ALS, and obviously this is not like that at all, other than the sense that it's the challenge, to challenge people and then to carry it forward. It's really flexible. It's unique. You could do a solo, a group. You don't even have to actually Mambo. So we don't want the name of the challenge to deceive anybody. We welcome interpretive dance or no dance at all. It's that easy. It's open to creative interpretation. If you're not feeling up to it, you can sit in your favorite chair, put on some music, any type, raise your arms, sway to and fro. You can ask your family and friends to make a video challenge for you. Whatever works, whatever is easiest for you. We don't want anyone to really worry about getting any of the dance steps right. They don't really matter. It's the awareness. We don't want anything to stand in anybody's way to initiate a challenge like this. We feel that the awareness message is key. Help make multiple myeloma a more recognizable cancer, especially beyond our own myeloma community. When people first hear it, they often mistake it for melanoma, which is a skin cancer. We're hoping folks will create videos and add to the ones that we're already seeing on YouTube. If you choose to make a video, be sure to include Mambo for Myeloma in your video title, along with any other words or associations that you choose to identify and personalize your challenge. And this way, we can all kind of have it in one place and find them easily. So when people want to initiate a challenge, they have a place to go and take a look and get some ideas. If you can't do a video, take a photo. Take a photo of yourself. Make a sign declaring you completed the Mambo. Use that photo to post to your Facebook page to challenge your family and friends. Just be creative. We've already posted many of these photos on our page, including your photo, Priya, which challenges the CURE panelists. You know, we have a lot of the videos on our page. You can either visit the Facebook page. It's called Mambo for Myeloma Awareness Dance Challenge Starts Here, or by searching the words Mambo for Myeloma on YouTube. They really are a testimony to how very different and unique this challenge is. Just like no two myeloma patients are alike, neither are two of these videos. We've seen a cheerleading squad, a hula hoop mambo, Mardi Gras mambo, Gary's famous Mambo for Myeloma Man, a classic solo mambo, sisters from Australia dancing for their mom. People are really making these their own, adding photos of the person they're doing the challenge for. It's really been great. You know, we're telling people, take a photo with your myeloma specialist and use it in your challenge. Include your pets. They're part of the family. The concept really has no limits. So we're just hoping that you could do this challenge with your family and friends, even if you've already have an event planned to raise donations for a myeloma research organization. Just add it to your event and emphasize the awareness aspect of it to continue to spread the awareness after the runners have crossed the finish line or that last basket of cheer has been raffled off. It's just a way to really kind of keep what you've already accomplished going and carrying it forward. You can, you know, you may end up actually reaching someone who has not yet donated to your cause by doing it this way. We just partnered with a group in the UK training for a six-day, 226-mile event, raising funds for their UK Research Center. They're called the Myeloma March, and they'll be adding the Mambo into their training sessions as well as during the days of their march. Their mom was diagnosed 9 years ago, but the awareness will continue after their event with the video challenges that they're going to do. I think as a community, we should try to get myeloma recognized beyond the myeloma community. It has to start with our community. We need to be the ones to initiate it, to get it beyond those who are already familiar with it. We really can't wait for anyone else to step up and take up the cause and do it for us. It takes one challenge to start it. Challenge as many as you'd like. There's no minimum, no limit. Again, whatever works for you. You know, our kind of tagline is the power of one. You and I will become the power of many. So we just hope people will have some fun while they ramp up the awareness factor. So we're hoping the Cure Panel members that you challenge, Priya, will dust off their dancing shoes and mambo for myeloma awareness.
Thank you for that, Dana. I do hope they take up my challenge and mambo for myeloma. Listeners, call on you to increase awareness on multiple myeloma. Thank you, everyone. The link for today's broadcast will be shared with all the participants. Please join us again for our next myeloma panel, which is scheduled for October 15th, when we will be talking to Dr. Amrita Krishnan on bone damage in myeloma. Please visit curepanel.carefeed.net to register for our shows. Until then, thank you.
Dr. Trico, thank you so much. Really appreciate your contribution.